welcome to Useful Idiots. This is our first post-inauguration recording. And
it's a special show.
Special show for a special day and a special time. Racism and imperialism are over.
It's all over. The world is back. Actually, it's now advanced to a state of pure awesomeness.
Yeah, and awesomeness and enlightenment. And who else would we want to talk about this with than the most enlightened person who will ever talk to us? And that's, of course, Thomas Frank.
Thomas Frank, who's going to join us the whole show. Welcome, Tom.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here and spread my enlightenment.
we're basking. That's what this is. This is a collective basking. We're recording after the inauguration, so we're in the middle of a feeling of great joy among the land. Tom, what was your
warmth? The warmth is just sort of, you know, percolating through our bodies. First of all, is relief. So I will confess, I was just so relieved when I woke up this morning and the world was still turning, and Donald Trump's helicopter was on its way out of D.C. That made me pretty happy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Biden stepped up and gave his dreadful speech, and it was dreadful.
Let's get into the dreadfulness. It was dreadful.
That's my opinion. But it was the thing is, what flavor of dreadful? Okay.
Right.
Most inaugural speeches are pretty bad. And we should also trade stories about, I've been to a bunch of these inaugurals.
Uh-huh, yeah. Which ones did you go to?
So I went to Trump's, and I went to Obama's, but I actually didn't go to the mall that day. It was too crowded. I went the day before.
And
I remember the first one I ever watched was Jimmy Carter I was in sixth grade, and they pulled us all out of class, and we all sat in front of a big TV and watched. And I will tell you, I was, 10, 11? And I really admired him. I mean, when you're that age, you know, and he seemed like such a good guy compared to Nixon and all that.
Yeah, he is, wasn't he?
Well, of course. And as before you got on, Katie, we were talking about Christopher Lash. And Carter actually, called Lash into, I don't know the whole story. Carter had a conversation with Lash. And out of that conversation came his worst speech, which was the famous malaise.
Oh, he wrote that.
'79.
So historian Christopher Lash inspired the malaise speech. That's
interesting. That's right. So I watched that, and I remember exactly where I was when I watched it. I was in, you know, my parents' bedroom in our suburban home in Prairie Village, Kansas, and I thought Jimmy Carter was so great. We had this philosopher president. He was so smart. And then, like, it took several days for the media to decide this was the worst speech of all time. And my initial reaction was that this guy is fantastic. But,
So how does that compare with today, though?
I'm trying to remember what Carter actually said in his inaugural.
Well, so he was trying to be honest about what, like, all the different things that were empty about American life.
Yes, but there were echoes of Carter in Biden's speech. You know, we are a good people. You know, we all need to come together. We need to end this period of, what did he call it, an uncivil war.
Right.
It was all very Carter-esque. Now, maybe you guys thought Biden's speech was excellent.
I just thought it was like anodyne, and like it was sort of like a dial survey speech where they just kind of threw a bunch of cliches and connective tissue out there.
Exactly. It was just.
I have no memory whatsoever what was said.
I've read it three times and I'm having trouble remembering it.
Yeah.
And anodyne is exactly right. I mean, it is exactly, it's just one cliche after another. And, you know, he had that long quotation that he said was from a song. I looked it up. It's from a song that, yes, it's the theme song of a Ken Burns special.
Really?
Oh my God.
Ken Burns. Ken Burns. Well, he said it was a quote. He just didn't give the source, but it's from a Ken Burns special about World War II, a Ken Burns series. And he also echoed really strongly a very Ken Burns esque historian, which is John Meacham, all that crap about the better angels.
Wait,
better
Meacham angels as of in our nature. The Biden person who was working for Biden and didn't tell MSNBC?
Yes. Well, yeah. But that's like Biden has been echoing him all through the whole campaign. I mean, but this is a master of cliches that we're talking about here. You know, the cliche ideas, cliche expressions.
Yes.
Malarkey.
Everything. Yeah.
So I thought of a funny way to talk about this, if you guys will allow me, which is I was looking up exactly 100 years ago on a different inaugural inauguration day.
Let's try to guess what writer could be talking about what presidential inauguration.
Oh, come on. I have to tell you who. No, okay. I'll go ahead and read it and then you can guess. But I already said he's talking about Warren G. Harding. And this is what the journalist said exactly 100 years ago. He said, setting aside a college professor or 2.5 dozen dipsomaniacal newspaper reporters, he takes the first place in my Valhalla of literati. He's talking about Harding. He's first place in my Valhalla. That is to say, he writes the worst English I have ever encountered. It gets better. It reminds me of a string of wet sponges. It reminds me of tattered washing on the line. It reminds me of stale bean soup, of college yells, of dogs barking idiotically through endless nights. This is the best. Wait, it gets better. It is so bad that a sort of grandeur creeps into it. It drags itself out of the dark abysm of pish and crawls insanely up to the topmost pinnacle of posh. It is rumble and bumble. It is flap and doodle. It is balder and dash.
Dash. Wow.
I think we all know what writer that is.
That's H.L. Mencken, my hero.
I'm surprised you didn't go for Harding.
Isn't that funny? That's 100 years ago now.
Where was the Bosch and Bunkum? I'm kind of a little
I'm only reading part of the essay. It goes like trying to describe the idiocy of this. So Harding would misread words famously. Uh-huh. The famous one is the word was normality, and he read it as normalcy. But there are a whole bunch of them like that. And Mencken just thought this was hilarious.
Can you explain who Mencken is for listeners?
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have said H.L. Mencken. Yes, he was the great journalist of that era of the teens and the 20s. Wrote many, many, many books, edited the American Mercury. And when I was younger, I used to try to imitate his style. But this is a guy who is a real misanthrope. He didn't like anybody. It didn't stop with Warren G. Harding. He didn't like Wilson either. He didn't like Coolidge. He hated Roosevelt. He hated everyone.
Yeah, he's kind of my hero, actually. Yeah, I wonder what Mencken would have said about today. It would have been.
Oh my God! Well, the thing is, there's nothing like that is permitted. So English journalism, that you still encounter that kind of attitude, that just like over the top swaggering insult, you know. Mm-hmm. But you just don't see that in America, especially about an inaugural address. You know, we're all supposed
unless
to be so
it's
nice.
Coming from the other side, right?
But actually, I take that back. People were incredibly harsh about Trump's, and I saw Trump.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear my Trump inaugural story?
Yeah.
So I go down there on that day, and you know, you're the idea in DC is you're just supposed to be able to walk out onto the mall. You weren't able to do that this time. Nobody, did you see? There was nobody there this time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I got down to the mall, and there were all of these security. This is for Trump's inaugural. There were all kinds of security measures in place, and so you had to go through all this shit. And so I get down there, and I'm standing in line, but you can clearly hear Trump's voice through these megaphones, through these loudspeakers all over the National Mall. And I'm standing in line to let me out onto the mall. And there's all these Trump supporters around me. And I swear to God, it started raining with his very first syllables. So like he started speaking and it started raining at the exact same moment. And I made some remark like, you know, how about that? It started raining. And the woman in front of me said, it's Jesus's tears. And then she clarified, she said, they're tears of joy.
Right.
I love that.
Not sad tears, happy tears. Yeah.
Right. Jesus is happy. He's so happy that Trump's president that he's like weeping. And I actually, you know, Trump got really hammered for that speech. Do you remember American Carnage?
Mm-hmm.
But I thought there was something, I didn't think it was a good speech, but I thought there was something really interesting about it. He talked about deindustrialization. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
He said, like, talking about factories standing like tombstones. Mm-hmm. It was this kind of a good image. I'm sure Steve Bannon wrote it, you know, but it reminded me of when I was writing Listen Liberal. I went to this town called Fall River, Massachusetts, where they have
I grew up not like 5 miles from
there. Oh, well, you know what I'm talking about then? Those mills, you know, those mills, and they're all over the city landscape and they're completely vacant from top to bottom. Mm. And they do look like tombstones over the city. And that was exactly the image that I thought of. And so I kind of thought that was, sort of okay.
Yeah, because his convention speech was basically like a worse version of Nixon's silent majority, like law and order thing. And they reconfigured it to be this quasi-populist concept about crumbling America. And it was really dark and apocalyptic.
Yes.
Right.
I think we needed that. I mean, he did nothing about any of it. I mean, he just turned out to be the biggest charlatan who ever sat in the Oval Office. We should also debate that. Like, how bad is he? You know?
Right. We have for Biden, we rate things by golden leg hairs. What could we do for Trump? How many golden? What could that be? How many?
How many scalp reductions? That's 3 scalp reductions way up. Well, okay, but this is an important question because we got to get to this. So obviously we had the Capitol riot, and I know that you've been writing some stuff on this theme of how exactly productive was this last 4 years of just kind of relentless sort of anti-Trump propaganda that came from a unified front of basically elite culture in this country.
So that's we're changing the subject from Trump to anti-Trump, which is fine with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but at some point we got to go back and think how bad a president was he? And it is fascinating that he saved the very worst thing for last. You know, the storming of the Capitol. You know, what the hell?
Yeah.
You know, it unleashing his followers on his own vice president, like. I still can't get my head around that one, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I just wanted to pause this really good chat.
You get it? Pause?
I know it's really rough out here for a lot of people, but I wanted to give Matt the chance to talk about something.
Well, I mean, Katie, has your pet helped you through the pandemic this year?
So much. She's really cute, so I cuddle with her. She's very amusing. I bring her on my shows. She was on Useful Idiots last week.
Look, from the beginning of the pandemic, PetSmart has been an essential retailer, making sure that you can get everything your pet needs. And right when you need it, they have 1,600 convenient locations. And they lead the pack with safe and easy ways to shop while we're doing canine metaphors. They're cleaning and disinfecting products. They follow the CDC recommendations. Everybody wears face coverings or masks. They're required for employees and for pet parents. There are decals on the floor and signage and new protocols that reinforce social distancing requirements. So if you've had a catastrophic brain injury and you don't remember where you are.
Catastrophic,
and you're stumbling around and you don't know what you're doing and you look down
the floor
is going to remind you to socially distance at PetSmart. And they've got plexiglass shields in place at the registers and also at the salon and pets hotel lobbies. They got stores and grooming salons where they offer digital check-in, curbside drop-off and pickup, and contactless payment. You don't have to have any real contact with a human being when you go into this place. So, you know, PetSmart, you know, look, it's responded to the unprecedented demand for contactless shopping by adding curbside pickup for website and app orders. And now, Katie.
Yeah, Matt.
It's offering free same-day delivery powered by DoorDash through January 31st, 2021, so you can get everything your pet needs right to your door and right when you need it. PetSmart's associates really love pets. They love caring for them, and that's a big part of why they work there. And they're as an essential retailer since the beginning of the pandemic. They've made it safe and easy for you to do care for your pet, too, online or in stores. At PetSmart, the health and safety of employees, pet parents, and pets is what's most important, which is why they require face coverings, support social distancing, and have installed plexiglass shields and enhanced cleaning to follow CDC recommendations. Or if you're interested in contactless shopping, just order online at PetSmart.com or in the PetSmart app and enjoy free, easy curbside pickup or free same-day delivery. Again, powered by DoorDash. We've mentioned that twice, but it deserves to be mentioned twice, don't you think?
It does. We can't dash over it.
Right. Through January 31st, so you can get everything your pet needs right to your door and right when you need it. So check out PetSmart.com for more details. Actually, just go there recreationally. Just go check it out, right? It's better than other things you could be surfing for.
All right, that pause was long enough. Let's go back to Tom.
We switched over today. Like, we had, like, a formal switch over from, like, media, nonstop media rage to nonstop media sycophancy, right?
Yes,
and,
yes.
And it was kind of amazing, like, to watch, like, Chris Wallace was like on near tears and saying that this was the greatest inaugural dress that I've ever heard. Here's a quote from a Washington Post guy. Joe and Bo used to watch an eagle soar by the dock. Now, when Biden steps to a lectern, he will be greeted by a presidential seal. It features as its most prominent symbol, a bald
eagle.
Wait,
an eagle. Yes, I got it.
And there was the thing last night where the guy on CNN was talking about how the lights lighting up the mall were like Joe Biden's arms wrapped around America.
Yeah, he's like a political director or something.
John King saying there's an air of cleansing about today. So, okay, like for most people, it's just like, ew, all right, whatever. But I think, you know, for half the country, this is like, it's probably going to work on their psyches in a very specific way. And I know you've been interested in this. I'm just curious what your thoughts are about that, Tom, because you have particular ideas about how all that went
so
over.
We should also talk at some point about how what we thought when Trump came in and how our minds have been changed. But I almost immediately, once Trump got elected, became fascinated by Trumpism is fascinating, but anti-Trumpism is also really goddamn interesting. And the way that people would almost instantly, you know, ramped it up to 10, you know, went to this kind of hysteria, what was the term that I used? Agastitude, this constant air, constant wailing that's been going on now for 4 years, everywhere that you turn. And that is, I think, just as fascinating as Trump, and it's going to outlast Trump. This is now, Trump is gone, and the agastitude is still with us. And I mean, we're in a brand new media climate, a brand new cultural climate. Let's go ahead and just go all the way here. A brand new cultural climate that I think is totally unprecedented in American life, where you've got this, well, unprecedented in our lives. None of us remember the 1950s. But there is an absolute consensus, an like airtight consensus among cultural elites in this country of a kind that we have never seen in our lives.
In our lives, yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's an amazing thing to behold. It's also really, none of us are part of it. We're all outside of that consensus. Mm-hmm. And so we're, you know, looking from the outside in. But this, what I call it is a consensus of, you know, of the aghast. And I don't know how they're going to, you know, process the next 4 years, but we're in a really strange time in America where it's not just this, that they've come together in a kind of airtight consensus where if you want to write, we're journalists here, if you want to write for one of these sort of mainstream publications in America, you have to accept this, their party line. There's no other way. If you're a Republican, if you're a Democrat, whatever you are, you have to share these certain, you know, preconceptions of agastitude. And one of the things that sort of made it okay and made it kind of fun is that it was an opposition. It was a consensus of opposition. Right. But now it isn't. Now it is fully in charge. And it's not just, you know, a coming together of elites against the president. It's a coming together of elites with the president.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is, we are entering a new world. And there's also, I mean, we can talk about all the different elements of this, you know, what it includes, what it doesn't include. The aspect of it that blows my mind is that, well, there's many aspects of it that blow my mind. The first one is that it includes the intelligence agencies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, what mm-hmm. the hell? Like, since when have they been part of the, like, the liberal consensus? That's just almost too strange, you know?
Haven't they been part of it for a while, except they haven't been?
They were part of it back in the 50s.
Optics-wise?
I certainly wouldn't think so. I mean, I've been a liberal all my adult life, and I never regarded the intelligence agencies as allies or friends.
You're talking about liberals. I thought you meant Democrat presidents. You're talking about the civilians, the non-presidents, non-politicians.
Democratic presidents, you know, that's a different, you know, that's certainly right, a different ballgame.
Culturally, that whole security state thing was never part of, like, the liberal intellectual elite. But now they're, like, fused in a way that it's very weird, right?
Yeah.
And very healthy.
They're all commentators. All these former guys are, you know, commentators on
CNN,
et cetera. And you've also got, you know, the situation where you've got monopolies, cultural monopolies emerging all over the place. By the way, did I ever show you guys this when I was doing the Baffler?
He always does this, yeah.
sorry. I was doing the Baffler magazine back in the day. Commodifiers, the new Gilded Age. And the big idea that we were all writing about at the Baffler was the idea of the culture trust. The idea of, you know, that culture had come under a kind of monopoly control, which in the 90s, that was not, you know, that was kind of an exaggeration. Today,
right.
It's true. I mean, there's the newspaper industry. It's basically three papers, and the Wall Street Journal doesn't really count because their online presence is extremely limited.
Right.
But, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, you know, that is it. And they increasingly resemble each other.
Yeah. Well, the whole kind of left liberal media landscape, which was pretty fragmented and pretty representative of lots of different sects, even 5 years ago. It's almost exactly tonally all the same now.
You'd say it's been cornered.
Yeah,
and they've rolled it up.
Yeah,
it behaves like a monopoly, and then you also have real monopolies. You know, Facebook,
right?
Google? You know, real monopolies out there. You know, astride the culture, and people are just finally now starting to understand the danger that this represents. And one of the things that has been most shameful, I think, about the Trump years, we're talking about anti-Trumpists here during the Trump years, is their constant soliciting of these cultural monopolies, to soliciting them to crack down on their rivals, on people they disagree with.
Yeah.
This is like crazy. I mean, it's Cold War behavior. You know, it's not quite McCarthy, but we're getting there. You know, McCarthy was a blowhard and an asshole. But if you go back and read about the culture war, the Cold War climate, and ignore McCarthy and look at all the other stuff that was going on in America back then, it was scary. And we are heading right towards it again right now, is what I feel. That's the way I think about it.
Well, like, look at the way Matt is totally marginalized, and Glenn Greenwald, and, you know, other people, Max Blumenthal, Aaron Mate, Rania Kallik, all these people who, if they're retweeted by a politician, you have people swarming the politician and urging them not to retweet them. That's just in the world of Twitter. But people are totally tainted. I mean, there really is this really lazy labeling of someone's being tainted or toxic, and there's no evidence required, and people are just written off.
Yeah, taint because they're communists.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, now they're not communists; they're Putinists.
Right.
So they signed on to one of these front groups. The Communist Party used to set up these front groups, and they would lure people in
because
the front groups, they'd have really attractive names.
Right.
You know, they'd be like, "We're doing good things in the world," and so well-meaning people would sign up, and then 20 years later, some asshole would find that they had attended a meeting,
right?
And then they'd get fired. They'd get canceled. Yeah. They'd lose their job. You know,
The John Reed Society. My uncle, great uncle.
Well, that one was, it was pretty easy to see that that one was,
I guess so. Yeah. Communist. Not that covert, right.
But there were a lot of them, you know, and some of them were like totally anodyne, you know. You know, they had like dance clubs and music clubs, right. And, you know.
So what's going to happen going forward, though? Because I always thought that one of the strategies of the Trump years, like from a propaganda standpoint, was like it was implied that you couldn't have a slow news day because that was logistically impossible. It had to be an emergency. There was no such thing as a day where something wasn't terribly wrong, because as long as he was in the White House, it had to be. So we had this like never ending string of like manias and panics about different things. And then, of course, there was a real one at the end. But
has to continue, Matt. That's the problem. So now you're an expert on the journalism as industry.
And right.
That has to continue. Now, here's the question. How is it going to continue?
How are they going to sustain the emergency going forward, or will they? Like, I mean,
they've got to. Can you imagine? Are we all going to go back to the, you know, to the 90s?
Right.
So I've been doing a lot of looking back at my older work recently, and it's funny how different the climate is now. So my first book was about the dot-com bubble. It was, well, that putting that one aside, that was like an academic book. But my first commercial book was called One Market Under God. And it was about the dot-com bubble and this period of euphoria in the 90s, which was exactly the opposite of the Trump years. You know, in the Trump years, everything was disaster, a gastitude constantly, disasters right around the corner. And in the 90s, it was the opposite. It's like, hey, millionairehood is right around the corner.
Right, right.
Do the right thing. And oh my God, look what happened. You just made 800% in a single day. And I used to subscribe to Fortune magazine. I would have CNBC on all the time to get that flavor into my writing, this like incredible euphoria, you know. And I would subscribed to Fortune magazine, and each issue was like 300 or 400 pages long, because it was so thick with advertising.
You know, oh my God. Yeah, that's right. All the magazines were like that. They're, you know, they were just,
yeah. And journalism, you know, these people made a good living writing for magazines like that back then, you know. But it was absolutely the complete opposite. And I wonder, I mean, Can we shift gears? Can we go back to like nonstop euphoria? Can you go from hysteria to euphoria?
Yeah, how are they going to do it? Because
but I agree with you. I think the model now requires hysteria and requires hate.
Right.
And I don't know. I don't know where they're going to get that from. But it's actually not hard to. I mean, as we've all seen from Twitter, as we've all learned from Twitter, it's not hard to make a tiny misstep or a verbal gaffe into a problem for the ages. We've all seen this happen to people.
Right.
And right.
How similar was this to going from Bush to Obama?
Good question.
Well, it was,
Bush was really hated towards the end. Remember?
He was. And also remember, Obama was elected in part because of, there was this euphoric feeling, among other things, about like a dismantling of the war on terror,
right,
and the end of all of these stress-inducing adventures in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. But most importantly, Obama came into office in the middle of the financial crisis. It was still unfolding when he became president, and people thought, and Bush had been very Trump-like, and he, you know, Trump dealing with coronavirus, the way he dealt with it is like to do nothing, right?
Right.
I mean, it's like zero leadership. And that was Bush on the financial crisis. He just washed his hands of it. He had no idea what to do. You know, he turned it all over to Hank Paulson. Do you remember that guy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The whole sending a letter to Congress. I need $800 million in 3 minutes. Yeah,
exactly.
He's the one who knelt in front of Nancy Pelosi, right?
Yes, he did. And the Fed bailed out AIG all on their own. They didn't ask anybody's permission. They just did it.
That's right.
Oh my
That's
God. Right. And yeah, then so Obama coming in, it did feel like we had, Obama was so, you know, palpably a better man than Bush, you know, just like better, superior in every way. And that's what I thought at the time anyways. And I thought that, you know, this guy is going to, he's going to, you know, swing into action, and right. he's going to, you know, he's going to pull a Franklin Roosevelt, and it's going to be great. And I was certainly optimistic.
I was too. Absolutely.
Yeah. But there is a bit of a difference also in that Obama was seen as really unprecedented, right? So it wasn't, he wasn't seen as a return to normal. Whereas Biden obviously is seen as a return to normal because he's older and because he's white and because he's been vice president, because he's been a senator for so long.
That's right. Do you want me to, I can make that even when you say that about Obama. One of the reasons I supported him is because I thought he would root out the influence of Clintonism in the Democratic Party. I sincerely believed that. I'm almost ashamed to admit it.
I bought that too.
But it took a couple years before we understood that it was just the same. It was the same crap, you know.
And there also
made me like him was after they went after Jeremiah Wright. Remember that?
I sure did.
With Hillary Clinton, and they went after his pastor. That's when I started.
There's another guy I knew. Bill Ayers was a friend of mine.
Oh yeah,
really?
Chicago. Yeah,
he went. And, he sent his kids to the summer camp I went to.
Oh really? So I knew his kids quite well. He was. It's funny the shit that he got in those days because he's in person he's just the nicest guy in the world, Bill Ayers.
Yeah,
and he was always just super helpful when I was doing the Baffler magazine. He was just the best guy around. And I when all this shit happened to him, I wrote about this for the Wall Street Journal. Isn't that funny? I wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal called "My Friend Bill Ayers." I know,
the terrorist.
That's clickbait.
No, it was real. It was real. I mean, he really was my friend. And it was while all this crap was happening. It was in that summer of 2008, you know. And
okay, well, there's another question we gotta ask ourselves, which is Tom, we didn't get a chance to talk to you about this. How do you feel about the Capitol riot? And B, you know, they're talking about some pretty intense responses, like a domestic terrorism bill, which the squad opposed last night. Yeah. But if that goes through, like, you know, what's the likelihood that we're going to go enter this domestic war on terror period, which, you know, that's I feel just, like there's a non-zero chance that will happen. You know?
That seems like such a bad idea to me.
Right.
I mean, the thing is that do we need a new bunch of laws? Everything those guys... No. did was all is already illegal, you know. You're already not allowed to storm the Capitol, and you know what else is creepy is as far as I'm concerned, those Capitol police have no I mean, we haven't done any hearings yet, there haven't been any press conferences yet, there probably won't ever be, but like, how did they not know that was going to happen? I still don't understand that. I mean,
yeah, we're going to have some clarity about whose orders those were to stand down and all that. But you know, I think one of the things they're talking about in the FBI is already there have been stories about how they were limited in their ability to conduct surveillance on some of these people because, you know, that there isn't a designation that they could have used that would have allowed them to get a warrant or something
oh
like
my
that.
God. I strongly doubt that. And B, this is just, you know how dangerous this is. I mean,
of course,
domestic spying. We've been down this road before. And I just want to say I'm pretty liberal. For liberals to encourage this or be in favor of this you are sowing the whirlwind, my friends. This is the worst idea imaginable. It's always going to come back to at the left.
Yeah.
You look back through American history at who has been surveilled, who's been deplatformed, who's been had their lives ruined, and it's always people on the left. And we're not just talking about the 50s here. If you go back to the 1920s, you know, when they were throwing guys in the IWW in jail, they were deporting people, you know, for their political views.
Yeah, the Palmer Raids.
Not right wingers now. They were deporting leftists for their political views. And
same thing after World War. Roosevelt did it in 1942, right? Socialist.
Well, that was fascists. That was the famous. They put a bunch of fascist leaders on trial.
They did, and anti-Semites, but they also did socialist worker parties. That was the first set of
I did that I did not know
sedition trials. But But yeah, no, but then, you know, then we had the domestic surveillance. Remember that whole Cy Hirsch story that came out in 75? And it was like sort of decided by all the newspapers that, you know what, we're not going to do this. We're not going to follow up on this story that much. And that just...
But that's a, that's one of the biggest, you know, scandals of all time, that you talk about the COINTELPRO stuff here.
Well, that came out. That's the stuff that came up. Yeah, right. The stuff that came out around the time of the Pike Church.
Yeah, I can't believe we go back down that path again. I mean, look, there's already laws in place. We need to, you know, we need to see what went wrong, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we can talk about what needs to be changed. But the idea of like unleashing domestic spying, this is a terrible idea. You know, it's
and
funny.
And it seems like it's for the first time. I mean, this has been sometimes liberals have ignored this as a threat a lot, but usually leftists, and that's a whole, what does that mean? But I think we all know somewhat what I'm talking about, but this is the first time when actual, I think there's so many lefties who think that this is a good idea. And I've heard this, there's this weird argument, which is that if you say it's going to bite us in the ass more than anyone else, they go, well, they're already doing that to us, so who cares? Let's do it to
what
the
does
right
that mean?
Now.
They're already, what? So that's a, you
it
know, that's.
They're already
incredibly irresponsible, you know, for these people to think that this is a, and it, what, where it comes from is, you know, we were talking earlier about the coalition of the aghast and this kind of consensus, this airtight consensus among elites. And I want to come back to that in a minute, but there's, I mean, this consensus is especially strong in a place like academia. And
but I'm talking about more radical leftists who aren't in academia, but anyway, so that we can, that's a whole other thing.
Okay, but these people believe that they, that their control over cultural legitimacy, that their grip over cultural legitimacy is never going to end. And I am here to tell you, they are so utterly mistaken. They are so utterly mistaken. I want to talk about this. I want to, one funny story, and then we'll talk about the coalition of the aghast again. Mm-hmm. And the funny story is this. So when I was younger, I used to be a punk rocker. And
what instrument did you play?
No, I mean, like, I was a fan.
Oh, you know? I see.
And the instrument was the turntable, and I had a show on the college radio station, and I would, you know.
Nice.
And there was everybody's throwing around this word sedition, and I'm like, huh, sedition. That was the name of Malcolm McLaren's shop on the King's Road in London.
Was it really?
Seditionaries. Yeah, because look at our commercial culture, and this is the whole conflict that nobody ever thinks about. Our commercial culture is in love with extreme. They use this word extreme all the time to sell everything, you know?
Right.
Extreme Cadillacs, extreme soda pop, you know? I used to write about this all the time. It's like, you know, so we have one part of our culture that's like, we got to crack down on extremism. We got to have a war on extremism. The other part of our culture is like, extreme. When you're really extreme, yeah. You know? it's like, what the fuck? Who are we? And then Joe Biden quotes from a song in a Ken Burns, you know, a Ken Burns.
So terrible.
Did everyone see the
we all need to like live life as though we're in a Ken Burns documentary, you know, then it'll all make sense.
Well, that would be good, because that would never end at that point. That would solve the eternal life question, you know.
But Tom, I just do think it's worth noting that there's another group of people who are not the typical like usual suspects, who really see themselves as more radical, and who are not, who like agree with the left, with us on a lot of things, and even they are for it in a way that's new. You know what I'm talking about, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, and leftists who are in favor of censorship, let's say.
Yes,
really.
Right. Who, again, it's not because they trust the elites or the institutions or have any kind of cultural capital or cachet or buy-in. It's because they just think that it's like, these are hateful white supremacists and they need to be deplatformed. It's that kind
they need to be thrown in jail is what needs to happen. They broke into the Capitol.
Well, the ones who commit crimes, but the problem is that they're one who, but this is not, that's not what they're talking about.
Well, look,
I'm saying the group of people who are being dumb about this is bigger than usual.
If you go on to 4chan for any length of time,
isn't that funny? So I've never done that. I don't even really know what you're talking about.
Oh,
keep going.
Yeah, I mean, like, if so, basically, like a lot of these right wing, like far right wing sites, it's like the intersection of like where porn and political thought converge. Like it's so messed up and so violent. And I mean, and it's got, it's literally got porn images with like racist jokes with, you know, plans for violence, like all mixed in the same posts and stuff like that. And it will freak you out in pretty short order to be on there. And I can see how people can be following some of the trends, you know, in QAnon and places like that, and think, well, we got to put a lid on this. But you can't put a lid. That's the thing. You put a lid on it, and all people are going to see is that there's a unified front of very rich people, you know, who are not going to let them talk about stuff. And that, I don't think that's going to go over well. I just,
you know, I what would be funny is if the religious right got on board with this and is like, well, okay, we'll let you do that if you also abolish pornography.
Right. Yes, exactly.
That would actually be kind of funny. That would be just the fiasco that would ensue. That would be hilarious, you know.
Oh my god. That would be like the 80s turned inside out.
Yeah, it would be, right? it would be a hoot.
Yeah.
But here's the other thing that we were, you know, that we never, one of the consequences of these guys storming the Capitol, one of the consequences of this these guys attacking the Capitol is that it derailed all the other conversations that were happening. And the conversation that I was most interested in was the election. For God's sakes, that's the last time I saw you guys on election night. Mm-hmm. And the results, the results weren't fully known for quite a while after that. And the results are really interesting. So Biden super won, obviously, but Trump was not repudiated in the way that everybody assumed he was going to be. He did quite well. He did better than every pollster said he was going to do. And there was that amazing shift of Latino voters in certain places.
And black men.
Trump. Yes. And then there was the other shift. And none of this, I mean, because it's all been wiped out now, it's all forgotten already. And this is hugely important. And this is, I think, probably more consequential in the long term than the Capitol, than the, you know, these assholes storming the Capitol, you know, because this is how politics works, but it's already forgotten. But here's the aspect of it that gets me. So when I talked to you guys last, I was in Johnson County, Kansas, which is the wealthy white collar suburbs of Kansas City, Missouri. And it's a sort of white flight suburb, you know, suburban area that was built largely in the 1950s, but it's still growing. It's by far the richest county in Kansas. I think it has the most people of any county in Kansas. And when I was a kid, and we grew up in this little corner of it, that's very affluent, right? And I mean, very affluent. This is the ruling class of the city. These are the people that own Kansas City. These are the people that own the state of Kansas. And they were my neighbors when I was growing up. And I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas is largely about these people, because these are the most Republican people in America. Mm-hmm. Or they were, right? They had not voted for a Democrat. They had not voted for a Democrat since Woodrow Wilson. It's the last time Johnson County went for a Democrat. And when I was a kid, the Republican Party controlled every local office. They controlled, well, the governor of Kansas would come from there, you know, and Biden just flipped it. And I went back and looked at the precinct. Biden won that area, the whole county, right? And I went back and looked at the precinct results for that little corner of it where I was speaking to you guys from. Biden won every single precinct. Wow. In that richest little neighborhood in the state of Kansas, in the city of Kansas City. It's incredible. So there's a huge shift underway in this country. There is a coming together of elites that we've never seen before in our lives. And you look at another thing that we're allowed to talk about here, we are talking about it, but it got erased from the national conversation thanks to this idiot riot. The lout rampage, and that is the business community cutting off the Republican Party. Did you see this?
Yeah,
it's quite incredible. Well, first, if you know the fundraising totals are finally in for 2020, and Biden massively outraised
1.1, yeah.
Biden outraised Trump, and Biden took the sort of commanding heights industries, the important industries, so Silicon Valley, Wall Street, both went with Biden.
Pharma.
Trump, pharma. Trump took big oil.
Right.
Trump took casinos, although that turns out it's just a single guy, Sheldon Adelson.
Right.
And now he's dead. R.I.P. He died.
R.I.P.
Yeah. And then as soon as that riot is over, the Wall Street starts cutting off the Republican Party. All these other industries start cutting off the Republican Party. We are in the middle of an incredible, a shift of the tectonic plates. It is happening before our eyes. This gathering of the elites, this consensus. And they're gathering of the elites behind Biden, behind the Democrats. I don't know how long it'll last, but this is I've never seen this in my lifetime,
Right. Right. But and then the question is, though, what does that mean going forward? Because the Republican Party, they have a couple of ways to go. They either can try somehow to wedge themselves back into legitimacy, like with that crew. But the other way is the Josh Hawley way that they're already
the workers
flirting
party.
With. Yep. Right. Yeah. And yeah.
Well, what do you think they're going to do?
I mean, I don't know that they'll be competent in either direction, so I have no idea. But clearly, the numbers would go the other way,
What do you think, Katie?
The numbers would go which way? The populist way? The pseudo populist?
Pseudo populist way feels like it's the only way they can go.
That's certainly what wins elections. That's as Trump taught them.
Right.
Look what he did, in 2016, he beat Hillary Clinton, but he also won Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan.
With half the money.
Yeah. The Republicans have to walk this very fine line. They want to be the party of business, but they also want to reach out to these sort of disgruntled, white working class types and win those places. And if they can do both, then they dominate. But now it looks like they have to choose. I've met a lot of Republicans here in Washington. It's kind of hard to imagine them not being the party of business. I mean, they're everything about them, it would cease to make sense.
Right.
Does that just look like socially reactionary policies? Because aren't right-wing populists, which as you've pointed out and written about, that's not a real thing. It's like
it's a phony. It's an act.
A phony thing. But they don't believe in the labor movement, right? So they're right, just
of course.
What, they just
of
want.
Course. They hate those
so, like,
guys.
What is that even? What does their thing even look like? What does their economic program even look like? What would it look like?
Well, it's not about economics. It's about messaging. It's about, Reagan's patriotism. You go a military buildup, right? Is one way to be.
Can I drop some knowledge on you guys?
Yeah. Sure.
It's some kind of amusing knowledge. So I'm reading this book right now. This is John Meacham's biography of George Bush Sr.
Wow.
I know. Like, why? Why would I read that?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell? Why would anybody read that? Well, I'm reading it. And so George Bush Sr. is like an American aristocrat. He comes from, his dad was a senator. They come from, and his grandfather was an investment banker, and they can trace their ancestry, but way, way, way back. I mean,
cave paintings in France. Basically.
Yeah. These are as close to aristocrats as this nation produces. So in 1988, he's running for president and he's faced with this guy, Michael Dukakis. And remember Dukakis? He's like, it's not about ideology. It's about competence. What's Bush's and by the way, Dukakis has this incredible bounce after their convention. He's like 18 points ahead. Okay. What does Bush do? How does he challenge this guy? It's entirely culture wars. It's prison furloughs, Willie Horton. Yeah. They dug up this thing where Dukakis had said something mean about the Pledge of Allegiance. So they would go around pledging allegiance all the fucking time.
Yeah.
And Bush would visit flag factories. And Dukakis was proud to be a member of the ACLU. Do you remember this? So they hammered him. They hammered him for these things. It was entirely the culture wars. And I remember I just graduated from college that year, and I was so angry about this campaign because it was so idiotic. And of course, Dukakis walked right into the buzzsaw. He's like, it's
with the tank.
Well, no, I mean, just refuse. He wouldn't call himself a liberal. He wouldn't, you know, mobilize organized labor. He wouldn't reach out to traditional Democratic. He was a Clinton before Clintonism.
He was a Clinton without.
Without charisma, without street
fighter sense.
Yeah. Exactly. Without any kind of smarts, without any kind of populist smarts. Oh my God. And Bush just crushed him. Mm. And the result was just devastating. Entirely done with culture wars and racial resentment.
Yeah. Right.
And oh my God. And that's so they have that. They're very good at that. They can still play that game. But I don't know if it works without the money behind them. You know, so they're in a real dilemma, these guys. I don't know what they do.
They can run against wokeism.
Yeah, no, that's true. That gives them a perfect target, you know, but
you know, there's a lot of things that could fall under that umbrella that would appeal to not just white people also.
Of course they can continue to build this sort of Trump coalition. There's no doubt about that. But I'm asking you to imagine Republicans without money. It's almost hard to picture. I grew up on things, you know, the Koch brothers and the Rockefellers, and these are Republicans. Right. You know, this is the people I grew up amongst. These are Republicans. This is the ruling class of America. You know, what is going to happen now?
Well, they're going to have to find some sponsor that, like, oil and gas is now almost so disreputable that it's out of the club for like the corporate consensus, you know, that maybe they'll be able to get money. But anyway, just to switch gears quickly, what are our expectations for a Biden presidency? Do they try to accomplish anything, or is this really going to be just a restoration of kind of the Pax Americana version of Obama's presidency, where expansionist military?
Look, Biden's, you can say this, he's got his work cut out for him, right? COVID and the economy. And it's like if he delivers in the first 100 days, if he really steps up to the plate and gets half the country vaccinated in the first 100 days, this country will love that man.
That's true.
And if he like really does it with his stimulus package and he gets the economy roaring, this country will love that man. And
but what was the thing that we just learned today that I was saying, Matt, that the Democrats aren't going to deliver anything till March?
They're not going to give him a COVID bill till March.
Seriously?
Yeah.
That's madness.
Well, they only control both houses, so he's got to act on
this immediately. And the thing is, like, if he acts on it immediately, this country, I mean, they will worship him, mm-hmm. Anyhow, we'll see. That's what I think he should do. And if he does it, he will, you know, I don't know if he's even going to run again. He seems too old already, but he'll be a successful president. But the alternative is Obama's third term, where he just sits around and says, oh, I can't do anything because those Republicans are so mean, you know,
they
keep outsmarting me all the time. They keep tricking me and, you know, back to the disappointment of the Obama days.
Right.
But how can he say it this time when they won all this stuff? Like, that's why I was so the most exciting thing for me about Georgia wasn't that I have any expectation for the Dems. It's that they won't be able to blame everything on Republicans and they'll be exposed.
Well, that was the case last time around, too. And they still did that. I mean, that's when Obama's first couple of years, they had a majority in both houses.
Yeah.
And they refused to do away with the filibuster. So they basically tied their own hands. And then Obama also, I mean, I liked him a lot back then, but let's be honest, he was fairly new to Washington. He'd only been a senator for 2 years before he became president. And so he was not really able to pull a kind of Lyndon Johnson, you know, where you get people to vote for things that they're against. It's possible.
Wait, but Thomas, you're the one who taught me that he didn't want those things.
That's exactly. So that's
by the end, there
are all sorts of things that Obama could have done without Congress. And the only answer that you have to, you know, conclude with by the end of his 8 years is he just didn't want to do these things. You know, he just didn't want to. He didn't try because, look, he's a smart man. He had Rahm Emanuel standing right next to him. He's one of the biggest assholes in all of Washington. And he could have said, you know, Rahm, go down there and pull a Lyndon Johnson and get this shit done.
He never did it.
And he had Eric Holder right there. He could have said to Eric Holder, you know, prosecute these Wall Street guys. We're going to make a big stink out of this. You know,
Rahm would have resigned before doing that, though.
Before getting tough with the conservatives or the blue dogs or whatever. Maybe. But, you know, he works for the president. So find another Rahm. This is the lack of imagination of these people is always so, when you compare it to the Republicans historically, not Trump here. Trump is just a fucking idiot. But when you compare it to Republicans historically, these guys are incredibly resourceful, innovative, dynamic, you know, coming up with new ideas, dreaming like that story I told about George Bush, you know, figuring out how to beat Dukakis. It's like, let's just talk about Willie Horton constantly. And this is the guy who dreamed this up was this character called Lee Atwater, who is this classic Republican, you know,
amoral character, yeah.
Evil genius. You know, they got a whole string of these. Steve Bannon, you know. They've got a whole string of these guys. And they're very, very good at the game. And the Democratic version is like Rahm Emanuel, you know.
Who
will not get tough with the people he needs to get tough with. He gets tough with, like, you know, the Chicago Teachers Union.
Black people.
Covering up the police murder of that kid.
McDonald.
Last question I have for both of you. Like, one of the things that amazed me about how I felt this morning was how glad I am that this is going to be over. Like, there was no entertainment value in the Trump era for most of it, I felt. And there was an element to the way he was covered that, like, always, like, really bothered me. There was, like, a glee about it that was just so off-putting.
Constantly beating up the stupid kid. You know, it's like these guys from CNN.
I tricked
the dummy. Look, I tricked the dummy again. Look, he fell for it again. But look at this.
There was just this intensity of of, you know, self-congratulation about how much more right we were than this guy. And it was like a mandatory tone everything.
I hated that. And that's when we go to write the history of these years, when we go to write the history of these years, will we reckon with the anti-Trump attitude, which is loathsome in its own way, exactly why, like the way you described it.
Yeah. And it's gone now.
Trump is gone.
Trump is gone.
Right. But that attitude is still with us and will be with us. And this is where we started the show.
But towards whom?
Well, towards Josh? They'll find somebody.
Maybe towards you guys.
That's true. Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. We're going to start looking around. And who's next?
And this is our periodic reminder that we don't like Trump. And there's a lot to go after him for. It just, again, trying to pull out of Syria or trying to de-escalate things, you know. Again,
he didn't even know what he was doing.
But for instance, the whole, and I say this a lot, but the narrative that he's a Cheeto Mussolini unprecedented threat who should have ratcheted things up with Putin was so stupid.
It was relentless.
Yeah, you know what I mean? But he had so many opportunities to be that, to be a strong man, to be an authoritarian, and he didn't take them. I mean, the most perfect one, of course, was COVID. I mean, this country was screaming for him to take charge and show some leadership, and he did nothing. And in fact, since the election, I don't think he's even mentioned it. All he's talked about since the election is how he was cheated. His brain doesn't work right, you know?
Actually, Tom, he's a genius.
Oh, is that what it is?
What did he say about himself? He's a what genius?
A very stable genius.
Very stable genius.
That should be a band. Can we form a band called that?
Absolutely. But yeah, that kind of like mandatory, like get in line kind of a thing. Like I feel like it is gone. I don't feel that same kind of thing today, although maybe they'll find some other way to impose
it. I'm immensely relieved that he's gone and Biden is in there. But then I thought about it, and it's like Trump was great copy. I mean, not just for the anti-Trump people that you described, but I had a lot of fun with them too, with the situation that he set up. I mean, think about everything we've been describing here. He ushered us into a new and really interesting era. And I don't know how we're going to come out of it, of course, but like the craziest things have been happening the last 4 years.
Yeah, but that was only if you were allowed to explore all the angles to
right.
Trump.
No, that's right. And I write for foreign publications. So.
Right, exactly. What does that tell
and
you?
MSNBC won't have you on anymore, right? It used to be regular. Well,
I don't know what happened. They lost my phone number. I guess they thought my pundit card got canceled. And I guess my pundit card did get canceled.
Well, no, you were critical of the Dems and not just the Republicans. So they know you.
And they don't want to hear that, which is totally weird.
So we're all agreed, though, today, a net plus, right?
Yeah, but I want to issue a warning that we're going to see a lot of woke washing.
What does that mean?
Oh, well, yeah, there's going to be a lot of that.
Whenever someone is terrible is a point, they're going to hide behind the diversity so that we have like...
No, the word for that is Clintonism.
It is Clintonism.
I'm serious. Go back and look at Christopher Hitchens' book about Bill Clinton. It's called No One Left to Lie To. And it's the first time that anybody wrote about this. And he said with Bill Clinton, he has all these reactionary or conservative ideas. And I forget how Hitchens put it, but he said that he muscles them through with a, you know, like a bodyguard of political correctness something like that. Yeah. And I forget how Hitchens was great when he was
good with words. Yeah. No, but woke washing is an important term, I think. I mean, I did. That's kind
okay,
of
so, no, you're right. That's actually best better than Clintonism. But
we're going to, you know, there's white. Obviously, there's greenwashing, pink washing. Right. Which is when Israel hides, like, you know, hides their crimes against Palestinians by pointing to how much they love LGBTQ people. And so this is like, we saw this example with Jonathan Martin, a New York Times journalist, who, when Cedric Richmond was named to some weird new made up position, which turns out, by the way, is basically a position to build outreach to conservative white people. Anyway, Cedric Richmond is a Black former congressman, terrible on energy. And when he was named for this new, for Biden's administration, the Sunrise Movement spoke out against it. And Jonathan Martin tweeted from the get-go, from the beginning, people are going after Biden's most influential Black staffer, which is exactly what's going to happen every time someone's criticized. Mm-hmm. Just watch. It's going to be framed as racist, sexist, anti-gay.
Were you guys at the 2016 conventions by any chance? The Democratic one?
I was.
Yes.
Do you remember that moment where the Marine General came out on stage and gave that really kind of bloodthirsty speech? Do you remember that? And there was a gasp. There was an audible gasp in the auditorium. And then they pulled back the curtain and he had a unit of soldiers with him. He had a platoon of soldiers with him. And they were, you know, it was the Rainbow Coalition. They were from every, you know, visibly different background. And that was the first time I ever thought of this, that this ideology that you're describing, Katie, could be the rationale for empire. You could do it. You could
dream totally
up a way of like conquering the world and saying you're doing it for you're doing it for
imperialism.
It could happen.
It's really disturbing. Yeah.
Because the previous incarnation was, remember Thomas Friedman's golden straitjacket idea?
Yes, like we're doing it for the market.
We're forcing wealth on you.
Yes.
But now we're going to force
His model was Singapore. Do you remember this? Mm-hmm. Now, Singapore has a really interesting, here we're coming full circle. Singapore has a really interesting, you know, there's a lot of censorship in Singapore, but it's not direct overt censorship. What they do is they have a really, they do like what Trump wanted to do. They'd opened up their libel laws. So if you insult a politician in Singapore, he can sue you. So any kind of political speech is inherently, problematic. And so they constantly, any opposition politician that rises up, they sue them into bankruptcy. And they take any newspaper, I used to write for the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal is, it's not banned in Singapore, what they do is they limit their circulation. So they can only have like 500 copies on the island.
Wow.
Of each, yeah, that something like bad. Nuts like that. Yeah, and that's the model. It's a very modern day model for censorship. It's very clever.
Yeah. Well, that's what went through my mind with all this sedition stuff is it's going to become a way to artificially reduce certain kinds of media speech too, right? Because they're going to expand the definition of that to. But that wouldn't be private, what you're talking about. This is going to be a highly weird period of our history, and I'm kind of looking forward to it.
I was turning around, by the way. If you saw me turn around, that was because I was looking for my copy of The People Know. But guys, if you're watching this or listening to this, stop what you're doing and order a copy of The People Know, History of Antipopulism.
So here it is. You see, I'm rewriting it right now with one of my.
Maybe you should call it The People Yo.
Yeah. What up, people?
Yo.
Yeah.
The People Yo.
Listen up, liberal.
Yeah. Just call it Trump is an existential threat. Just call it that. And then
Actually, I don't know about that. Did you see? I saw one of the funniest things I've seen on Twitter recently was somebody took a photo in a bookstore, you know, a real bookstore, not Amazon.
Yes.
It was a remainder table, all these books about Trump.
Trump, I know.
That is pretty funny.
Oh, that was rich. That was great.
Yeah.
You know.
Proof of conspiracy, proof of whatever.
But Matt, didn't you write one right at the start? Didn't you write a book about Trump?
I did. It was a bestseller, Insane Clown President.
Yeah.
Well, look, today was it was crazy in the end of a really poor 4-year experience. So I'm glad to all be sharing, commemorating all that with both of you.
Yeah.
How about Pence rising to the occasion? Did you see that?
He did.
Pence was
rising from the ashes like a fly.
Yeah.
Rising from shit.
Right now, I'm going to go in the other room and I have a bottle of Rioja and I am going to consume it.
Excellent.
Because there's no parties here in Washington, no great parties to go to. For Biden's inauguration, ordinarily you'd have your choice. Right. There'd be all sorts of wonderful things going on, but
just go find where Hunter Biden is, and
that's where the party is. And mask up,
$500 bills, and you'll be all right. He'll hook you up. All right. Well, this was awesome.
Yeah,
thank you, Thomas Frank, Katie. This was fun, right? All right, that was awesome. We're happier. Yeah. Than we were a day ago. So, but it's probably all going to be downhill from here, but we'll be there to tell you all about
subscribe.
It.
And so. Subscribe to Useful Idiots. Hit subscribe and then hit the bell. Rate and review us on wherever you listen to us and never ever listen to or watch Positive America.
Vomit uncontrollably instead if you're thinking about doing that. And thank you, Thomas Frank, for joining us.
Hey, this was a blast, guys.
All right, take care and we'll see you all next week.
All right, so long.
Bye.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.